You turn into the book of Genesis. What time do we quit? 7:45?
Yeah.
Give or take. Okay. Book of Genesis. Tell me what you know about Joseph. What do you know about Joseph?
Son of Isaac.
Son of Isaac? Okay. Jacob, right? Son of Jacob. So, yeah. So Isaac was his grandpa. Same family though, so it's the same thing. What else? Okay. Yep. And who is the second son of Rachel? Benjamin, right? Okay. Good. What else?
Favorite.
I'm sorry?
Favorite.
A faithful?
Favorite.
Oh, the favored son. Yeah. Okay, so what was the token? What was the sign of his status as the favorite son?
Coat
of many colors, right? Yeah. Okay. Anything else come to mind? Specific situation in Joseph's life that just sticks out?
He had dreams.
He had dreams? Yeah, starting from about what age? Does anyone know? 17, yeah. Yeah, good stuff. That's Genesis 37, verse 2. We'll go and turn over there. That's about where we're going to start. So you're grinning like that was a guess.
I opened up to Genesis, and there it was.
Nice. I love it when things work out. Genesis 37, verse 2. Will you read it since you're there?
Yes, this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad is with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report to them of his father, to his father.
Okay. So Joseph showed himself to be, what's a good way of putting it? Willing to snitch, yeah, I guess that's the nicest way to put it. And then later on in chapter 37, he starts revealing his dreams to his father, which were what? You remember those two dreams?
That his brothers would bow down to
him. Okay, so the brothers would bow down to him. That was the message of both dreams, but what were the dreams specifically? The sheaves and the stars were bowing down to him. And there's a phrase in there, I don't remember which verse it is, but Jacob heard these things, his brothers got upset, but his father kept the matter in mind. Verse 11. So, interestingly, the same thing is said about Mary, referring to Jesus in the New Testament. She kept these things in mind, I believe, in Luke chapter 2. So I thought that was an interesting correlation. So he starts having prophetic dreams, possibly around 17. We can't be dogmatic about that. He could have had them sooner or later, but around that age. He's then going to be sold to Egypt. He's going to run away from Potiphar's wife, be in prison for at least 2 years. And then when he's 30, he'll be exalted to essentially Pharaoh's right-hand man. So there's a 13-year gap between chapter 37, we first know the first information about Joseph all the way up until he's released from prison. And so 13 years is the time span between those two events. He'll then, of course, be reunited with his brothers. His father will die, and then he will die at the age of 110. So he's sold into slavery maybe around 20, maybe late teens. So he spent at least 80, 90 years in Egypt. And that's going to come into serious play here as we go along. So, comments or questions about the timeline of Joseph's life? Really quickly, put a finger there in Genesis and turn to the book of Psalms. Turn to the book of Psalms. Will someone read Psalm 81, verses 5 and 6?
This he established in Joseph as a testimony when he went throughout the land of Egypt, where I heard a language I did not understand. I removed his shoulder from the burden. His hands were freed from the basket.
Okay. And then we won't take the time, but Psalm 105, verses 16 to 24. It's not It's not a point that we're going to spend a lot of time on, but I think it's at least worth mentioning. Joseph was a historical figure. He wasn't a myth. He wasn't a legend. He wasn't, you know, just a really good feel-good story, you know, to throw into the book of Genesis so people can learn some moral lessons years down the road. He was a person. He was a historical figure. These events truly did happen. So, again, maybe not the most groundbreaking for those of us here, but something that we should at least remember. So, comments or questions about the introduction to the book of Genesis, specifically Joseph? Okay. Tonight, we want to look at four specific decisions that Joseph made and draw some conclusions about his character, and we'll make some application from those choices. Because how do you know a person's character? Through their choices. You know, you can hear rumors about a person all day long. That doesn't really tell you anything because they could be true, they could be false. To truly know a person, you have to watch how they behave. You have to listen to the words that they speak. You have to listen to, you know, watch the way that they present themselves to other people. How do they behave? What are their actions? What are their choices? So tonight, if we're going to do a character study, then we need to look at some choices that Joseph made. So turn to Genesis 39 if you're not already there. Genesis 39. I feel like this is a passage we should probably read, so we'll go ahead and read verses 1 through 12. 1 through 12. Will someone read that? Genesis 39, verses 1 through 12.
Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, the Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites, who had taken him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. So it was from the time that he had made him overseer of his house, and all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Lord was on all that he had had in the house and in the field. Thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was a handsome man in form and appearance. It came to pass after these things that the master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." And he refused and said to his master's wife, "Look, my master does not know what is with me in this house, and he has committed all that he has to my hand. There is no one greater in this house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you. Because you are his wife, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" So it was that she spoke to Joseph day by day, and he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. But it happened about this time when Joseph went to the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house were inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside.
Okay, so backstory. Joseph, as we read, he has 12 brothers. He has 11 brothers, excuse me. One of them is younger by the name of Benjamin. 10 of them are older. And something I feel like we should emphasize too is sometimes we might think of like Reuben and Simeon and Issachar. You know, they may be teenagers or early 20s. These guys were probably in their 30s to 40s. Like, these guys are probably considerably older than Joseph. So these aren't, you know, as the VBS curriculum depicts, these aren't like little 12-year-olds selling their brother into slavery. These are grown men making these decisions. So that's something we should keep in mind too. So their brothers, they sell him into slavery because they're upset with him. He's ratted them out to their father. He has these dreams that they're going to bow down to him in the future. You know, he's this little runt of a kid that, you know, they don't really respect at all because, again, he's shown himself to be a snitch. And so the opportunity shows itself. You know, he comes to them in the field, miles away from their father, and they sell him into slavery. Initially, the plan was to kill him, right? They put him down into the pit, and they're thinking, you know, maybe we should kill him. And Judah comes up with this idea, let's not kill him, let's just sell him into slavery. Because it's going to essentially be the same thing, but we don't have to carry the guilt around with us. So they sell Joseph into slavery to the Ishmaelites, and the Ishmaelites eventually sell him to an Egyptian man named Potiphar, who was in some sort of authoritative position. We don't know what that position was, but he was a pretty high-ranking guy. And so he's working for Potiphar. Put yourself in Joseph's shoes for a second. You're miles and miles away from anyone that you've ever known or met. You're in your late teens or your early 20s, surrounded by people more than likely who don't speak the language that you speak, so you probably can't communicate very well. You're upset because you've been betrayed by the people that are supposed to protect you, who are supposed to have your best interest at heart, and here you are hundreds of miles away from home. In fact, I have the specific number. More than likely, it was 430 miles. That's far for us today. But for them, it would have taken weeks for them to get Joseph from where they were all the way down into Egypt. So again, put yourself in his shoes. All of a sudden, you know, you've been doing great things for your master. You know, you're just showing yourself to be truly successful. You're just constantly being promoted. But even so, you have the nagging thought at the back of your mind, more than likely, I am never going to wake up in the morning or go to bed at night as a free man. More than likely, I'm going to die in this position as someone else's property. It would be very tempting, I would think, to lose hope. And to not only lose hope, but to give up on God completely and to say, listen, you know, God has allowed me to be put in this position where I'm never going to see my family again. I've been betrayed by the people who are supposed to protect me. And now this woman is throwing herself on me. How am I supposed to respond to this? How does he respond? He responds with integrity. He constantly tells her, you know, that's no. And then eventually she literally throws herself on him and he runs out of that situation. For a person of his age, and not only the fact that he ran away, but the fact that he had respect for God, but also out of loyalty to his employer, to his owner. Like, that just blows me away every time I read it. He's not only worried about God in this situation, which of course I'm sure was the majority of it. He's also thinking, you know, my master trusts me. And as a person, I can't defile that trust by doing this great wickedness. You know, I can't do this to the person who trusts me, which, of course, has spiritual implications, but also just implications for us as people. You know, it's like, how am I supposed to interact with the people around me? Well, number one, if a person trusts me, you know, if they've invested in me and they have every reason to believe that I'm, you know, doing what I'm supposed to be doing, then taking advantage of that and behaving in a way that's going behind their back and that's deceitful and sneaky, that's not okay. It's not okay. Any comments or questions about this specific instance?
So, Stephen.
Yeah.
You bring up excellent points that the Bible brings out. In a time where our nation, our people, don't really see anything wrong with that per se. That's my business. I can do what I want to, just my life. Mm-hmm. Not understanding the ramifications and the problem that it causes, not only mentally, but emotionally, and from a familial perspective, it tears up everything. And so for Joseph to have in his mind that I'm not going to do this wickedness toward God, and he's telling her that, I'm not going to do this against the master, it says a lot about him, and it says a lot about what his father instilled in him before he went into slavery.
Yeah, and we won't go into the specifics of it, but if you actually look in Genesis 38, which is the story of Judah and Tamar, then also his older brother Reuben had done some questionable things of the sexual nature. even if his father had instilled that in them, that, you know, we're going to behave well and this is, you know, the correct, this is the proper atmosphere for a sexual relationship with a person, of course, within marriage, he still had the examples of his grown older brothers who were not following that example and doing something completely contrary to that. So even if his father had been saying all those things, he still had the example of his older brothers doing very, very different things. Which I would say strengthens the argument for Joseph's personal character, his personal integrity. Even if my brothers are doing things that they shouldn't be doing, that's not going to change the fact that I'm going to do what I should do. He also had the knowledge that, you know what, no one's ever going to know about this. No one else is in the house right now. My father and brother, my family members, my moral support system is hundreds of miles away from home. And if you don't think that that plays a factor, consider the decisions that college kids oftentimes make. You know, the minute they step out of their family's homes, you know, they've been faithful Christians for, you know, 10, 15 years. And then all of a sudden, mom and dad isn't there to tell me to go to church on Sundays. And then 2 years later, you know, you wouldn't even recognize that they had at one point been associated with Christianity. But Joseph in this situation, he literally has no one. And he still chooses to behave himself well. So Joseph chose integrity over pleasure. And also, I think we can make another point. He chose integrity despite pressure. Because think about it from the other perspective. From Potiphar's wife's perspective, she can make things very difficult for him. She was already making things very difficult for him. You know, his life was tough because, you know, not only did he have to be strong one day, it seems like he had to be strong every day. You know, and it wasn't, even in a moment of weakness, he didn't give himself that out. You know, it's like, well, I said no yesterday, but I'm just going to do it and see if she'll get off my back sort of thing. He showed integrity and then he maintained his integrity moving forward. That's amazing. To be able to be strong one day, but then to be able to be strong for, you know, and again, as we've already established, this could have been years. You know, he could have been years in Potiphar's house, but he still chose to behave himself well. So he chose integrity over pleasure and despite pressure. Turn to Titus 3. Titus 3. Let's make some quick application. We'll move on to point number 2. Yes, sir.
When our integrity matures to the point where it doesn't matter the situation or circumstance, mm-hmm. then you're living.
Yeah.
That's when you're living.
Yeah.
Before that, it's always that struggle of where am I? Who am I?
Yeah.
But when you know who you are, it doesn't matter what comes your way. I know what I'm gonna do in these situations. Mm-hmm. It takes time to get to that point, but Joseph was already there. And so when you get to that point, you're living the life of God.
Yeah. Good point. Anyone else? Okay. So I want to read Titus 3 and verse 3.
For we ourselves were also once foolish, disobedient, deceived, serving various lusts and pleasures, living in malice and envy, hateful and hating one another.
Focus on that phrase there, serving various lusts and pleasures. Would you agree that there are people in our society who love pleasure? I don't know what else to tell you. There are people in our society who wake up and they go to bed and it's just a hedonistic lifestyle. It's what can I experience today that's, you know, going to give me the most thrill? What can I do to bring most excitement? I just want to have fun. I want to sow my wild oats. And these aren't just kids, you know, our age. These are like grown adults who are, you know, in their 40s and 50s, and they're still behaving this way. They're in love with pleasure. They're in love with various lusts and pleasures. And the Another important word here in verse 3 is they're serving various lusts and pleasures. From that perspective, the idea of I'm going to live the way that I want to, it sounds in our minds like that's as free as I can be. I make my own decisions. I'm going to live the way that I want to. I get to choose. I'm the boss. But if you read the New Testament, it's actually the opposite. It's at that point that we actually become slaves to sin. I'm actually throwing away my freedom and what I think is freedom. Turn to James 4. James 4. We'll look at one more and then we'll get to our second point. James 4. And the point we're trying to make is that loving pleasure has spiritual consequences. Someone read James 4, verses 1 and 2.
Where these words and cries come from among you? Do they not come from your desire for pleasure, but born your members? You lust and do not have, you murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and mourn, but you do not have, because
you do not ask. Okay, so in Titus 3 and verse 3, we see, if you love pleasure, you're deceived because you think that you're free, but you're actually enslaved. But here in James 4, verses 1 and 2, what we see is if a person who loves pleasure is in the church, they're a source of contention. They're a source of conflict. They're causing problems in the church because they have this war going on inside of them. They're saying, I love God, I serve God, I obey God. But then on the other hand, I also love pleasure. And I'm a servant of pleasure. And if Jesus told us anything, is that you can't be double-minded. You know, you can't hold on to pleasure or mammon or money, I believe is that passage says, and hold on to righteousness at the same time. You're eventually going to have to choose one. But before you choose, in the meantime, you're causing problems in the church. You're causing division. You're causing conflict because you're holding on to two different worlds. So we can't hold on to pleasure and to righteousness at the same time. Eventually, we have to choose. So loving pleasure has spiritual consequences. Another point that we'll visit again here in just a minute is that personal tragedy does not justify sin. Personal tragedy does not justify sin. And that's something that we know intellectually. But until we're in a position where, you know, my spouse, my mate has cheated on me, or I've lost a child, or something along those lines, it's at that point in time where you see the highest rates of infidelity, right? Well, my spouse cheated on me, and so I get a get-out-of-jail-free card, essentially, is the attitude that many times you hear in the world. And then also, you know, I've just lost a child, and I didn't mean to, I wasn't planning on it, but, you know, 2 years have passed, and it's like we're roommates, you know, we're sleeping in different beds and, you know, we're just not talking anymore. We're not communicating. And when we do talk, we're just fighting. And I found myself in a position with someone at work and, you know, here I am. I didn't mean to. I wasn't planning on it, but here I am. Personal tragedy does not justify sin. And even if I'm in the position where I want to make myself the victim of my circumstances, I still don't get a get-out-of-jail-free card. I don't get to justify doing something wrong just because I feel like I've been slighted by life. Another point we consider is that the potential consequences of resisting do not justify sin. You know, if I'm in a position at work and the boss comes in and says, hey, you know, I know you've got this report due on Friday. I want you to fudge the numbers a little bit. I want you to look, make us look just a little bit better for the shareholders. What do you do? You know, my job's on the line. You know, I'm trying to feed my kids here. And my boss comes in and I'm just going to tweak a few numbers. The incentive of pleasure, but the consequences of pressure, neither one of them justifies sin, is the point that we're trying to drive home. So, any comments or questions on this first point?
It's interesting that you say that because I think there's a message that we give as Christians that the Christian life is wonderful and that doing right yields right consequences or rewards instead of consequences. Mm-hmm. But as in Joseph's story, sometimes doing the right doesn't yield you the physical consequences or the physical results that you feel that doing right should do. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm making sense in this.
No, absolutely.
But I think we miss that message, especially when we're talking to young people, that sometimes doing right will not yield you a positive reward.
Mm-hmm.
It will yield you consequences, but your integrity should be stronger and willing to suffer that wrong, even though you did know wrong.
That's right.
And I think there's something in, is it in James that talks about willing to suffer wrong from your, I guess, employer or boss?
Mm-hmm.
And if you take it, this is well-pleasing to God. I feel like sometimes that's the message we miss sending to those who are willing to go into Christianity with a full and open heart, counting all the costs as they do so.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what passage that is? I was thinking 1 Corinthians 6. Is it the idea of willing to be defrauded?
This is a different one.
Okay. Well, if you find it, let me know, because I'd like to know.
1 Peter? Yeah.
You know what verse? You just let me know. All right, so Joseph chose integrity over pleasure and despite pressure. Number two, Joseph chose faith over self-pity. Joseph chose faith over self-pity. And this is kind of a continuation of some points that we've already made. But because of Joseph's decision to get himself out of that situation, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to give in to this pressure. And he ran out of the room. He literally ran so fast that he ran out of his outer garment. And so eventually he's going to be accused of sexual assault. His master is angry and puts him in prison. Joseph is in prison for at least 2 years. At least 2 years. And it's 2 years after the situation with the butler and the baker. Does anyone remember that situation? Someone remind us. Okay, so there's a baker and there's a butler that have been accused of something by Pharaoh. They're put into prison and they have dreams one night. Well, Joseph has been shown to be able to interpret dreams. So he says, tell me the dreams. He interprets them. And one of them is going to get out of prison. I believe it was the butler. Is that right? The butler is going to be released. He's going to be shown to be innocent. And Joseph says, by the way, when you get out, you know, put a good word in for me if you can. He forgets about him. The butler forgets about him. And 2 years from that point onward, Joseph is still in prison. And so how long, what period of that 13-year span Joseph spends in prison, we don't know. But he's in prison for years. If he was tempted to feel sorry for himself in Potiphar's house, I think wallowing in that self-pity is now completely justified. I don't think any one of us would fault Joseph for, you know, getting kind of down, getting kind of discouraged and say, you know, what's the use? I've literally done everything to the best of my ability. I worked hard for Potiphar, despite the fact that, you know, he owned me, for crying out loud. I still did good work. I still showed myself to be a person of integrity. And now I'm accused of a crime. And now, worse than being owned by someone, I'm now in prison for the foreseeable future. And so what now? You know, I don't think any one of us would fault him for wallowing in that self-pity. But what does he do instead? What decision does he make? He maintains his integrity. He eventually shows himself to be trustworthy to the captain of the guard, and the captain of the guard starts promoting him. So even in prison, Joseph is just showing himself to be stellar. You know, he's staying busy. You know, he's not allowing himself to become incredibly discouraged. He's maintaining his confidence in God, and he is maintaining his integrity, which I think is just absolutely amazing. You know, if I was in that situation and all of a sudden I find myself in prison for the foreseeable future, I can't honestly say I know how I would behave. But it's just a difficult situation, and it's so impressive Does that situation by chance remind you of anyone in the New Testament?
Jesus,
okay. Not the person I'm thinking of, but not necessarily wrong, of course, because he was accused of doing things that he was certainly not guilty of. Paul? Did someone say Paul? Yeah. Turn to Philippians 4. Philippians 4. Paul was also in prison for things that he had not done. He was accused of doing wrong when he was doing exactly what God had told him to do. Nate, if you will, read verses 11 and 12 of Philippians 4.
Not that I speak in regard to need, for I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. I know how to be abased, and I know how to abound. Everywhere and in all things I have learned both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need.
And go and grab verse 13.
I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me.
Okay, so that passage there, I think, summarizes Joseph's situation perfectly. Because he made the exact same decision. The situation he's in, I've done everything that I was supposed to do. I'm not guilty of this in the least. And yet, here I am in this situation. Nevertheless, I'm going to stay busy. I'm going to do what's right, and I'm going to make the best of my situation. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, when personal tragedy strikes, that, you know, no, I can't let myself be discouraged. You know, I've got to be super positive and kind of this Pollyanna attitude. That's not what we're suggesting. But by and large, my attitude should be to focus on things from a heavenly perspective. In the grand scheme of things, this is small potatoes. Dad always said that. I don't know what it means, but I think it kind of makes sense. It's small potatoes. It doesn't matter. It's very, very small in the grand scheme of things. From a heavenly perspective, this is nothing. It's nothing. And that's the exact same perspective that Paul had. I'm not going to let this get me down. I'm going to, despite the fact that I don't get to choose my circumstances, I can choose my attitude. I can choose my perspective. And I'm going to do the best that I can. I'm going to do the best that I can. Paul essentially said, you know what, I can't go out and evangelize, but I can write letters. I can have other people go out and evangelize. I can bring other people to me, and I can teach them in my house. So he chose to rise above his situation and to be productive, even when he had every reason to wallow in self-pity. So I think it's astounding. Any comments about that second choice there?
That passage is 1 Peter 2:18-24,
but 18-20 makes the point. Okay. 1 Peter 2:18-20 is the passage we were referring to earlier, if you'd like to look that up. So, okay.
Stephen?
Yeah. Maya.
I was just going to say, a lot of this, I feel like, encompasses the lesson that you brought last week about, you know, worldly wisdom versus godly wisdom, and choosing to respond to negative circumstances in your life in a godly way.
Right.
And like you said, you know, a lot of the world believes if something bad happens to you consistently, then your wrongful doing or your sinful acts is justified. Because,
right,
you know, I would too if this were to happen and things like that. It's understandable. But the godly wisdom says, I won't respond with negativity or to negativity with negativity. I
right.
will respond with it with positivity. And so I think that it kind of...
Yeah, good point. I hadn't thought about that. Anna.
Related to this, it reminds me of a verse in 2 Corinthians.
Okay.
8, in verse 12. And the context is talking about, you know, the monetary gift, but I think it applies to a lot of different circumstances. Since there is first the will of mine, it is accepted according to what one has, and not according to what he does not have. Because it's like if there's a will in the way, there's, you've already got a mindset like, I'm going to evangelize no matter if I'm in prison or out in public, or I'm going to do what's right, whether I'm a slave or whether I'm in Pharaoh's house. Like, if your mind is willing, you'll find a way to adjust.
Yeah, no, that's an awesome point. 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 12 is the passage he referred to, if you didn't hear that. Yeah, I hadn't made that connection, but, you know, his work ethic seems to be the same in both Pharaoh's house in the future, but also, you know, in the jailhouse where he finds himself currently. So that's amazing to me. I know I've said that like 12 times, but that's still just, that blows me away.
It's interesting that Maya brought that point up, because just today I was asked, do you believe in like curses or witchcraft? I'm like, yeah, I guess to a certain degree. What are you talking about? Well, we just keep having all this bad luck in it. But my husband said that I think somebody placed a curse on us. I'm like, but I wouldn't be surprised how many Christians think like that.
Yeah.
You know, like, just because bad things are happening to you doesn't mean that somebody put a voodoo doll on you.
Yeah.
You know, which some of us, if you think like that, that's not right. Don't work at it.
Are we going to hear a sermon about voodoo on Sunday? And I think many people in that situation, if they were here, they would turn almost a fist in God's direction and say, listen, you know, I've done everything that I'm supposed to. I followed the letter of the law, and yet here I am, and some degree of this is your fault. You hear that attitude reflected in people today. You know, all of a sudden something's gone wrong in my life. I've been behaving myself well. And all of a sudden, you know, the eyes turn upward towards heaven and, you know, God is doing something and it's not fair. And many people have walked away from God because of that attitude. Things aren't going well for me, and so therefore God has it out for me, essentially. But Joseph doesn't choose that attitude. He maintains his faith and his confidence in God, regardless of what's going on. And we'll actually see that here in just a little while. So,
Steve, I also think that's a testament to his selflessness.
Okay.
I feel like our current times, you know, it's very ideological. I'm my own God, so what can I do for me? Or what can the world do for me?
Yeah.
And we see here, despite all the negative that happens, he was still there trying to help others.
Yeah.
So that's his selflessness. Emptying himself, filling himself up with God.
Which sounds a lot like Christ, right? Philippians 2. You know, he emptied himself. So, which goes back to our conversation. So, yeah, good stuff. Decision number 3, Joseph chose mercy over justice. He chose mercy over justice. Fast forward a few years, you know, Pharaoh has released Joseph from prison. All of a sudden, Joseph has gone from I'm a slave, I'm someone's property, to now I'm an inmate, to now I'm second in command over the entire nation of Egypt. So I think proportionally that's probably the biggest promotion in the history of the world. But now he's in this situation. He's essentially second in command over Egypt. And all of a sudden his no good brothers, they stroll into town and they need some help. But because time has passed, they don't know it's Joseph. They don't recognize him. More than likely, he's also speaking another language, so they don't make the connection that it's him. At that moment that they walk up to Pharaoh's house, I believe Joseph would have been completely just in having his brothers either imprisoned or put to death. I think he would have been just in making that decision. He had every right to. They had conspired to kill him. They had sold him into slavery, and everything that he had suffered up until this point was directly their fault. It was because of their decisions that he had gone through all this mess. And yet he doesn't make that decision. And he doesn't make that decision all the way up until the point that they're reunited. And then years pass, and all of a sudden when their dad is living in Egypt and their dad dies, they get worried again. It's like, oh no, you know, Joseph's been waiting for daddy to die, and now he's going to punish us. You know, he's going to do something to us. But even then, you know, Joseph shows this attitude. It's like, listen, this is what was best. And we can't not read these verses. Yeah.
So that's another way of reasoning.
It's true. Very good. Genesis 45, someone read verses 4 through 9. 4 through 9.
And Joseph said to his brothers, please come near to me. And they came near. And he said, and Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. But now, do not therefore be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to prepare to preserve life. For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a prosperity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So now, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all his house and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt.
So in this situation, Joseph makes the decision to essentially extend an olive branch where he had every right to extend justice. Again, I believe he had every legal right to have his brothers either put to death or to be imprisoned. Where do you think his mercy came from? Where did this mercy come from? Where?
From God.
From God? Okay.
Look, even throughout the situation that happened to him, all the ones that really were unjust did not receive the consequences that he did in his integrity.
So okay.
In those circumstances, God was being merciful. God was being merciful during the famine by giving him the dream.
That's right. Yeah.
He kept saying that, and God sent me. God sent me here. I mean, he had it figured out.
Yeah. I think his mercy, and piggybacking off what Evelyn just said, I think this mercy that he extends to his brothers stems from his perspective. And his perspective is, I'm small potatoes. You know, my life is very, very small in the grand scheme of things. And yes, I've suffered for this period of time, but ultimately, if I hadn't come here, then you all would have died. You know, you would have lost your lives. You would have passed away. for more than likely, a guy under the age of 30. Again, that's just an attitude that you don't hear in people today. It's like, yes, I've suffered, but it was for the greater good, and so it's okay. And Joseph just seems content to move on with his life, whereas people hold grudges over, you know, someone forgetting the bowl of mashed potatoes at Thanksgiving. I mean, you know, you compare people's tolerance to Joseph and bring it forward to today, and there's such a stark contrast of, you know, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. In the grand scheme of things, who cares? Because heaven's purpose was served through this situation. I think it's amazing.
Joseph also knows that God is going to mercy as well.
Yeah.
That would be what helps sculpt his perspective. Every single word we speak, every action we take, helps highlight or illustrate what kind of perspective we all hold. How quickly we become angry, how harsh we are with other individuals, what it takes, how much it takes to make us angry. And Joseph knew that, much like that situation with Potiphar's wife, that the greater good and what was best greatly outweighed that momentary satisfaction that he would have had from exacting justice.
True.
And he knew, like he even said in his explanation to his brothers, God sent me forth so that you would be preserved and that you would live. And so I know that my own sufferings don't matter in this situation. It baffles me that he says, don't be angry with yourselves either. He says, don't be upset with yourselves.
Yeah.
Like, it indicates to me that he had gotten past this point in his life long before for him to have this emotional stability and maturity and growth to be able to tell someone who wronged him so deeply, you don't need to be angry with yourself.
Yeah.
This had a purpose.
Yeah.
So he's consoling his wrongdoers. It's just amazing.
That is amazing. We don't have the time to get to the passage I was hoping to, but 1 Corinthians 6, 1 through 7 ties in with this very well, the idea of extending mercy when justice is due. And in that context, Paul is essentially saying, even if you're in a legal situation where you're in the right, isn't it better to suffer, to lose whatever it is in this situation, to be defrauded, in the name of peace, in the name of the greater good, I guess you could say. I'm willing to sacrifice my prerogative so that the congregation isn't divided. Again, I want to get into it, but we don't have time to get into it. Do you have something, James?
Yeah, just as though the speculation of scriptural mention, because you asked where he could have gotten mercy from.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation with him and Potiphar's wife, you know, he was thrown from prison. He could have looked at that as was mercy unto him instead of death.
That's true. And really, you know, both of your comments have made me think the fact that he was able to perceive of those things as merciful is amazing. If I was in Joseph's position and I'm thrown into prison for something I didn't do, it takes a very mature person to perceive that as mercy. You know, because the situation is the same, but how am I going to decipher it? How am I going to interpret this? I think it's amazing that he was able to see God's mercy in his suffering. Good point. We've got to move on. I'm sorry. Decision number 4. Joseph chose the unseen over the immediate. He chose the unseen over the immediate. In Genesis 50 and verse 25, it says, "Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, 'God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here.'" This passage is referenced in Hebrews 11 and verse 22. If you're taking notes. So Hebrews 11:22 is referring back to Genesis 50, and verse 25. I'd always thought that his faith was, I'm going to be buried in the promised land. That was his faith. You know, at some point, I'm going to be buried in the promised land. I don't think that's it. I don't think it's the fact that he was going to be buried there, because Jacob was also buried in the promised land. Jacob's body had been carried to the promised land, But the timeline was very short. From the time that Jacob died until he was buried was like a couple months, you know, because they mourned in that culture. I think his faith was reflected in his confidence that his descendants would be leaving Egypt. And at that point in time, Joseph had no reason to believe that his descendants would be leaving Egypt. Egypt is the wealthiest nation in the world. Joseph's family have prestige, they're held in honor, they're wealthy because of the things that Joseph had done. Joseph's spouse was an Egyptian lady. You go down the list, Joseph has every reason to believe that his descendants are going to be staying in Egypt because they're settled there. They have money, they have wealth, they have land. Their cattle have the best grazing land that you could hope for. But Joseph says, oh, by the way, our descendants are going to be leaving, and when you do leave, I want you to carry my bones with you. And this, of course, we know was fulfilled. Exodus 13, verse 19, when the children of Israel leave hundreds of years in the future, they carry his bones. And then Joseph is going to be buried in Joshua 24, verse 32, in the land of Shechem. We don't have time to get into it, but Shechem was actually in the general area of where his brother sold him into slavery, which I think is a nice little connection there. And then Abraham, his great-great-grandfather, had also offered sacrifices in Shechem. So we don't have time to go deeper. I'm sorry, but it's great material. Joseph is just amazing, not because his life was easy, but because his life was so difficult and he made decisions along the way that reflected his true integrity. I think he was an amazing man. He had a perspective that reflected a willingness to be right with God, but that also kept heaven in the forefront of his mind. And I think that's amazing. So thank you for your attention. If there's no other comments or questions, we'll conclude. All right. Thank you.